Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Shavuot Tov. Since we celebrated Yom HaAtzmaut recently, and this coming Friday is Yom Yerushalayim, I decided to talk with you today about a story of a woman whose role in the episodes of Sefer Shofatim at the very beginning of the Sefer play a very important role in the whole initiative of Kibush Haaretz and her pioneering spirit in settling the land of Canaan can teach us a lot about the role of women in this initial conquest of Eretz Canaan and about how we should understand what it is not only to conquer the land, but also to settle it as well. Those of you who have the source sheets, I will be following along with them. Sefer Shofatim begins with a transition linking us to the conquests of Sefer Yehoshua, and it begins on a high note with the anticipation that all of Yehoshua's endeavors will continue and that we will reach a climactic point such that Bnei Yisrael will enter the glorious days of settlement and stability living in their own land. Sefer Shofatim begins, Vayehi acharei mot Yehoshua. It has the same beginning as at the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, Vayehi acharei mot Moshe. Just as Yehoshua carried on the legacy of Moshe Rabbeinu, and the baton had been passed to him, and he was charged to conquer the land. So too, with the death of Yehoshua, we anticipate that the mission will continue, and everything that Yehoshua had hoped for will be realized. And yet, what we see is something very different. While Yehoshua had been appointed a successor to Moshe Rabbeinu, Yehoshua himself does not appoint a successor, and no successor is appointed for him. And in fact, as a result, Bnei Yisrael ask Hashem, Vayishalu Bnei Yisrael Bashem, presumably at the Mishkan, asking the Urim v'Tumim, Mi yale lanu el ha-Kna'ani batchila lilachem bo? Who is going to be the first to go up against the Canaanites and attack them? The question in actuality is a difficult one. Why are they asking who should go first? All of Bnei Yisrael have already been given their nachalot back in Sefer Yehoshua. They should really all be working in tandem, each tribe conquering their own nachala. And in fact, Yehoshua not appointing or asking for a successor, perhaps understood that at this point in Jewish history, times have changed, and that maybe it is better not to appoint one individual leader over all of Am Yisrael, but that the tribes themselves, each and every one of them, needs to take the initiative for their own nachala. Back in Yehoshua chapter 13, Hashem had already told Yehoshua, Tazakanta, Vata bayamim va'aretz nishara harbe me'od l'risha. Yehoshua had already been informed that he would not complete the conquest of all of Eretz Yisrael during his lifetime. And so the baton had been passed by Yehoshua to each and every one of the tribes, perhaps to each and every one of the Nesi'im of the tribes, to continue the momentum of the conquest mission. And yet the people feel that they need some initiative by one particular leader in order to help them maintain that momentum. So logically, Hashem says, Yehuda ya'ale, hine natati et ha'aretz biyado. Yehuda starts the process. And of course, the tribe of Yehuda seems to be a natural choice. Perhaps this is also a test for the tribe of Yehuda that will he be up to the task for leadership? Is he going to be able to actually show that he's ready for grander leadership roles after the conquest of the entire land has been completed? Yehuda shows that the tribe of Yehuda is ready and willing to to continue the conquering of the land. They begin to conquer an area known as Bezek, which is south of Jerusalem. They conquer parts of Jerusalem, the part that belongs to them. They burn the city and attack its people. And then they go and they attack the mountainous area and the Negev area and the Shvelah, the coastline lowlands area. It is in the midst of this conquest mission that we are going to be introduced to a story about Achsa, about a woman who is going to herself play a pivotal role, not only in conquest, but also in settlement. Yehuda conquers not only the important city of Yerushalayim, but as we see in source number two at the end, and source number one at the end, Vayelech Yehuda el HaKanani, Hayoshev beChevron, V'shem Chevron lefanim Kiryat Arba, Vayaku et Sheshai, Vet Achiman, Vet Talmai. They conquer the area of Chevron. Now, this is a very important area because, as we see in Sefer Yoshua in chapter 14, in source number 2, Kalev had already been promised this area of Chevron because he was the loyal spy. He was one of the only other one, of course, being Yehoshua, who had shown tremendous faith. Vayavod Chevron, Kalev had come to Chevron, and he had davened at Ma'arat HaMachpelah to be given the strength to be able to overcome all the obstacles, the giant obstacles, both figuratively, literally, and figuratively, that he wanted to be able now to realize this particular promise and conquer this area of the land. In fact, in Sefer Yoshua, he says to, Kalev comes to Yoshua, and he says to him, Ve'ata, hineh hechaya Hashem alti kasher diber, ze 45 shana. I have lived an additional 45 years after having wandered through the Midbar for 40 years. And he says, today I am 85 years old. Odeni hayom chazak, kasher biyom shloach alti Moshe, kechochi az, uchechochi ata, la milchama, velatzeit velavo. Kalev is now 85 years old, and he wants to conquer his special nachala of Chevron that was promised to him. He is 85 years old, and yet he says, I am as strong now as I was then. We should all feel that way at the age of 85. And he says, I want to go out to war. La milchama, latzeit velavo. In fact, this language has been noted by scholars to be reminiscent of language that is often used about a king. And therefore, the question becomes, does indeed Kalev intimate that he has kingly aspirations? Is he obliquely asking Yehoshua to appoint him as a leadership successor after Yehoshua's death? Kalev, of course, is the Nasi of Shevet Yehuda. But Yehoshua, as we had said, seems to understand that now is not the time to appoint one leader over all of the multifaceted tribes. And yet, Kalev takes the initiative when it comes to conquering the land. And when Yehoshua gives him Chevron as a nachala, we read that Kalev, together with the tribe of Yehuda, conquers the area of Chevron. But then we read further in source number 3, at the beginning of Sefer Shofatim, that there is another area that Kalev sets his eyes on in order to conquer that area as well. And that is the area known as Dvir, whose prior name was Kiryat Sefer, the city of the book. Now one wonders why indeed Kalev wants to conquer not only the land that was promised to him, Chevron, but also Dvir Kiryat Sefer. Apparently, according to archaeologists especially, this has been corroborated, this was a city of scribes, a city of high Canaanite culture. And in this area, conquering this particular city, it would mean destroying an important aspect of a Canaanite stronghold. And this would represent a momentous aspect of conquest. And yet in this particular case, Kalev does not lead the conquering of Hebron, of Debir, but he sets forth to seek out someone else who can accomplish this mission instead of him. Is it possible that as much conquering energy that he had, right now his energy is waning, be that he is an older individual? Or is it possible that he understands that he needs to enlist the volunteerism of the members of his tribe, or perhaps any other tribe, because he realizes that military fatigue, war fatigue is setting in, and now there needs to be additional impetus that he needs to spur the tribes on to continue their desire for the conquest mission. Says therefore Kalev in source number 3, Asher yakeh et kiryat sefer, ulechada venatati lo atachsa viti liisha. Vayelkeda Otniel ben Kenaz, achi Kalev hakaton mimenu, vayiten lo atachsa vito liisha. Kalev says, whomever attacks and conquers Kiryat Sefer, I will give him my daughter as a wife. And Otniel, the son of Kenaz, the younger brother of Kalev, conquers this area of Debir, and he's given Achsa, Kalev's daughter, as a wife. Certainly, it's a very unusual situation. We would think that a woman, a daughter, is being offered as a bride, as prize, to a warrior groom. But we have another precedent, which is also, or later on, we have another scenario when Shaul asks who will kill Goliath in source 4. We also find out that the warrior who will slay Goliath will be given Shaul's daughter as a wife. But pay attention to the difference in that particular scenario to what we read here with regard to Kalev and his proposal and his offer. Shaul not only offers his daughter as a wife, but he also says, Ha'ish asher yakenu, ya'ashrenu ha'melech osher gadol, ve'et bito yiten lo, ve'et beit aviv ya'aser chofshi bi'Israel. He also offers wealth to the individual who slays Goliath, and that his father's house will be exempt from labor tax. We need to keep these differences in mind for the moment. In actuality, the Midrash in source number 5 questions the way that Kalev even went about offering and proposing a prize for the warrior groom. Because as the Midrash says, Kalev is an individual who did not ask Kehogen. He did not formulate his proposal, his offer, in the proper way. And in fact, the Midrash chastises Kalev and says, Ilu lechado eved echad, haya noten lo bito? If Kalev had ended up with an individual who was an eved, who had been the one to conquer Debir, Kiryat Sefer, would he have offered that particular individual as a wife, to his daughter as a wife? V'zimei lo hakadosh baruch hu kehogen. Nevertheless, Hashem understood Kalev's proper intentions, and Hashem made it work out okay. But notice there is a measure of perhaps boastfulness, over self-confidence on the part of Kalev. He says to Yehoshua earlier on, Kechochi az, kechochi ata, la milchama velatzet velavo. He's very confident, Asher yakeh, whomever conquers Kiryat Sefer, ulechada venatati lo tachsa, viti liisha. And he's confident that it's all going to work out well, and that indeed she will get a wonderful husband, a warrior who befits her as to be his wife. Perhaps this overconfidence does nevertheless according to the Midrash, indicate that maybe he was not fit to be a leader over all of these people. With all that, we need to think about the anecdote in source number 6 that intrudes on the descriptions of the conquests of the tribe of Yehuda. In fact, there are a few anecdotes that appear within Perek Aleph of Sefer Shofetim that interrupt the list of conquest or lack of conquest by the individual tribes. And I want us to zero in and I want us to focus on this particular anecdote and see what we can learn about Achsa, a woman whom I have coined the first female pioneer. Let's look at this text very carefully. Vayehi bevoa. We read, and it was when she was coming. The question is, where is she coming and where is she coming from and where is she going to? In source 8 Aleph, the Radak says, Kivoa leveit ba'ala, that she is going to the household of her husband. We are dealing with a scenario of transition. There is a dynamism, and that's important to pay attention to because there is movement here, a change of stature and status. And that is what we really see in the whole beginning of Sefer Shofetim. We are changing from a people that wandered in the wilderness, and we are continuing to become a people that is going to have sovereign foothold and strong roots within our own land, having national autonomy. Vatisiteu, and she instigates him, she prods him. Who is the subject of the pronoun heivav, him? Is it Otniel, her new husband, or is it her father? Vatisiteu lisheol me'et avia. Literally, to ask from her father. What request does she have from her father? And who is supposed to be actually making this request? Pay attention, by the way, that Otniel is Achi Kalev HaKaton Mimenu. That in actuality, even though that we know that Kalev is Ben Yefune, and by the way, in Divrei HaYamim, he's also referred to as Ben Chetzron, Chazal do equate Yefuneh with Chetzron, and yet Otniel is described as the son of Knaz, and nevertheless he is the brother, if you want to understand Achi literally, the younger brother of Kalev. Chazal and other Mefarshim posit that in fact the mother of Kalev, who was originally married to Yefuneh, that is Chevron, when her husband died, she remarried an individual whose name is Kenaz. And that is why, although they seem to be brothers, Kalev and Otniel, nevertheless, we emphasize that Otniel is the younger brother. He is Katon, and therefore he has that vim and vigor to be able to have conquered the area of Devir. So who is she inciting and prodding to ask from her father? And what does she want from her father? Pay attention that the verb, v'tisitehu, lehasit, is not just a bland, calm, neutral request. In fact, that verb has some very incisive intimations and connotations. For example, in Eov, and I've pointed this out to you in the sources in source 7, the Satan, Hashem says to the Satan about Iyov, "Vatisiteni vo levaleo chinam." You incited me to destroy him for no reason. So the verb lehasit is a very strong verb. She's not making just a very simple, neutral, calm request. There is a bite to it, so to speak. What is she asking, or asking her husband to ask on her behalf? Hasadesh, she wants the field. How can a woman ask for property? Women don't usually inherit property. So why is she asking not only for a field, but the field? Let's continue to ask the questions, and then we'll elaborate using the Mefarshim. Vatitznach me'al hachamol. She dismounts from the donkey. Vayomer la Kalev, and her father says to her, Malach, what is it? What do you want? What is the matter? So if, in fact, she was inciting Vatisitehu, that she was prodding Othniel, and he was the subject of the pronoun Heivav, that he should ask from her father, indeed, in the end, we see that he does not go to her father in order to make this request. In fact, the Mefalshim say, for example, the Radak says, Hisita ba'ala lish'ol me'et avi asadeh, ve'lo hatzahu lish'ol. She wanted him to go on her behalf to ask from her father for a field, a sadeh, and Othniel did not want to ask. When she saw this, she goes on her own to her father. Back to her father's house, notice the movement. She's transferred to her husband's house. Now she's going back to her father's house in order to make this request. It's very curious that Othniel, the brave warrior who seemed to have been so active in his military expeditions to conquer Deville, now all of a sudden is completely passive. And indeed, he seems to pass the whole baton, the whole initiative on to his wife, Achsa. Mitzudat David says, he pitetalto latet la reshut shehitish al me'aviyah hasadeh. That really she was only prodding Othniel, that he, of course, she's under the jurisdiction of her husband, that he should give her permission to allow her to actually do the asking of her father. There is one other way that we could read this particular text, in fact, that Lish'ol, even though it is an infinitive, sometimes is understood as a gerund, that she was inciting him, that means her father. He is the subject of the pronoun Heivav, asking from her father, meaning that she was completely bypassing her husband. In which case, we need to try to understand why it is that she feels that she has the right to ask for land, for hasadeh, and in what context is she asking this, that indeed it seems Othniel says, no, my darling, this is really not my issue. I'm going to allow you to take care of it. This is a father-daughter matter, and I am going to bow out and let you be at the forefront of this whole request. The Mefarshim, for example, Radak, parallels this based on the influence of the Targum to when Rivka turns around and gets off the camel when she sees Yitzhak, vatipol me'al hagamal. And yet, nevertheless, the verb vatitznach seems to be not merely a sliding off the animal where she slipped off the animal just to greet her father. She's certainly not going to talk to him while she's still on the animal itself. But the verb vatitznach seems to be a stronger, more forceful verb, indicative that this is a woman on a mission. The only other place the verb tzanach appears in Tanakh, in fact, interestingly, is when Yael in Sefer Shofetim takes the tent peg and she drives it through the skull of Sisera, so much so that afterwards the tent peg, batitznach ba'aretz, it is inserted and it sticks to the ground. So reading this verb, batitznach me'al hachamo, it doesn't say batipol me'al hachamo. It seems that as Mitzudat David tells us, he pila atzma nafla bekoach, uch'ilu na'atza ba'aret. She fell hard with force, or she dismounted rather with great force, that she was as if sticking to the ground, and she landed on with perhaps we could say a thud, and her father looks at her and he says to her, Malach, Malach is a question that indicates there is a crisis. There is something troubling her. The Mitzudat David says, Ma nechsar lach asher tirtze levakesh alav. Something's wrong. Something's bothering you. What is missing? What are you going to ask? And certainly we've seen this question of Malach elsewhere in Tanakh, which also indicates situations of anxiety and crisis. The head sailor, the chief sailor, says, Malach nirdam, kum kera el elohecha ulai tasheta elokim lanu velo noved, right? He says to you now, what are you doing, you sleepyhead? Why don't you get up and start praying to your God? Maybe we can avoid the storm. And you have the question with Esther Hamalka, that Ahasuerus says to her, Malach Esther Hamalka, ve'ad chatzi hamalchut v'te'ath. So Kalev understands that this is not a normal greeting between father and daughter, that she has something that she needs to be resolved. V'tomer lo, so she says to him, Hava libracha, give me a blessing. It seems to intimate that she has not had a blessing until now. Why does she feel that way? And again, the term hava is a very forceful request. When Rachel has no children, she says to Yaakov, Hava livanim, v'im ayin meta anochi, give me sons, if not, I am a dead woman. Hava is a very forceful way of initiating a request. And what does Achsa want? She wants a bracha. She wants a blessing. Why does she feel that she has not been blessed by her father? Didn't he give her a blessing when he gave her over as a wife to the warrior groom Othniel? Well, she claims, Ki eretz ha-negev netatani, you have given me Negev-like land. I don't think it's literally the land of the Negev. It's a little too far south from the area of Hebron and Dvir. And by the way, we don't know exactly where Dvir is located, but it is presumed to be south of Hebron. But she says, you have given me, according to the Mefarshim, dry, arid land. V'natata li gulot mayim, and what I want are springs of water. V'yitein la Kalev et gulot ilit v'et gulot tachtit. And Kalev gave her upper and lower springs, perhaps basins, pools. In fact, there is an area that is not far from Hebron. It's been identified as Kirbet Rabud. And this area has, through archaeological diggings, been shown that there were multiple upper and lower basins or pools of water in that area. Let's understand what Achsa is really asking. The Mefarshim tell us, for example, in Source 8b, that Radak tells us, V'yitachen lefaresh bracha mamash, she tosefet tova, klomar, she yosif lo amash shenatan la, ki yedameh, shenatan la eretz smea v'yivesha, v'ze she'amera eretz ha-negev netatani, v'sha'ala she'yitein la od ha-sadeh she'yu bo gulot mayim, la'ashkot eretz ha-negev shenatan la. V'yesh lefaresh, od bracha kemo brecha betzere. According to Radak, what Achsa is telling us is that apparently she was given a gift by her father. She was given, however, Eretz HaNegev. Now, truthfully, there are those commentators who claim that really when she says, Ki Eretz HaNegev Netatani, they read it more figuratively, that you have made me figuratively like dry, arid land. And according to one scholar, Yigal Ariel, who wrote a very nice work on Yehoshua and Shoftim called Oz Ve'anava, he says, and I quote, he says, if you compare her to what we read later on when Shaul promises his daughter to the warrior who will slay Goliath, here, lo yiftiach yachad im ha'isha gam nedunya ve'achsa ta'ana mishum kach keneged avia shehi meshula le'eretz ha'negev. Figuratively, she is comparing herself to dry, arid land because of the fact that he did not give her a dowry. He did not give her a nidunya. And perhaps that parallels to Rivka, who says that she is not going to wait in order to build up her trousseau before she goes with Eliezer, but she's willing to go indeed with Eliezer immediately. She claims, therefore, that she wants a proper dowry. But what's interesting is she's claiming she wants land. Most Mefarshim, however, say that a woman would not necessarily initiate on her own, that she would get as a gift of a dowry, land, hasadeh. And therefore, the presumption upon based on the Radak and other Mefarshim is that she probably did get a dowry from Kalev. We know that this was, even though it is the laws of Nidunya, Shiuchin, are not described in Tanakh in detail. We know from Masechet Ketubot, especially chapter 4 in the Mishnayot, describes at length that this is part of the rights, the legal obligations of a father to a daughter, and it is part of the societal norm that this was what was bestowed upon a daughter when she gets married and is transferred to her husband's jurisdiction. Most of the time, however, the nidunya was movable objects. It is very unusual that land is being given as part of a nidunya because of the fact that one wonders then how this will take away from the inheritance of the family, from the inheritance through her brothers. And yet we learn in the Mishnah Masechet Ketubot, interestingly, that anything that comes with a woman as part of her nidunya always remains legally belonging to her. So that if it is indeed land, the land will be used for the benefits of the family, but when the parents pass away, the children of this woman, only the children of this woman, most probably according to halacha, it is the sons, they are going to inherit this land ultimately. And so it does remain in a larger sense part of her family. The land that was brought from as part of the nidunya is not spread out and equally divided among all of the children of the family if the husband had more than one wife. Nevertheless, she therefore seems to be saying, and the Mefarshim elaborate, that when she was given this gift, this bracha, it was not a bracha because he gave her Eretz HaNegev. Even if it's not literally in the southern Negev area, still in all, he gave her arid, dry land. It's very interesting that Kalev even thinks that he can give her property as part of her nidunya. Perhaps because he's been given a special gift of Chevron, which is apart from the usual Nahala of Shevet Yehuda, perhaps he felt he also could start giving out land as gifts. Pay attention that Devir itself is not necessarily part of the land that is inherited by Otniel and by Achsa. This was only, perhaps we could say, the bride price, the mohar, the conquering of Devir for the sake of being able to have Achsa bestowed upon this warrior groom as a wife. She therefore says to Kalev, I want an area with springs of water. I want hasadeh. I want an area, she obviously knows what she wants, which is tillable land, fertile land that she is going to be able to plant roots and she is going to be able to reproduce, plant crops, and she's going to be able to settle and establish herself and anchor herself in the land. Which means that what Achsa is asking is for a supplement to her dowry. She wants to make the land fertile, and she wants to be able to produce crops so that she could feed her family. There are those, by the way, who do look at this idea of wanting fertility as perhaps also indicative that she wants to reproduce, of course, a family. She wants to establish herself. She wants to settle in the land. She wants to plant roots. And that, because we are talking about something that involves a matter between a father and a daughter, that is probably why Othniel bows out. Notice that her focus is always on herself. Havali, not Lanu. Nitatani, Venatatali. It's all focused on herself. She's not talking about Lanu, right, themselves as a couple. So this seems to be a matter that focuses on the dowry, that she wants a supplement gift to it. She wants Hasadeh. She wants the fertile, tillable land. What she wants to do is she wants to make the land bloom, right, from the dry desert. The Da'at Soferim actually indicates that maybe she doesn't want a separate field, but she wants the ability to irrigate the land that he gave to her, somehow to be able to draw the waters from these basin areas. She is showing that she understands. Not only must we conquer the land, and that's very important to maintain the momentum of the conquest mission, but she wants to move forward to the next stage. She wants to move forward to the stage of hitnachalut, to the stage of settlement. Her initiative prompts us to think about the ramifications, not only of maintaining the conquest momentum after the death of Yehoshua, but also what it means to move on from conquest to the stage of hitnachalut, settlement. Because the question will be, will the other tribes perhaps follow this woman's initiative, this female pioneer, this chalutza who wants to till the land and make it bloom and build up Eretz Yisrael and settle it and establish her roots in it? Will the other tribes follow suit from an initiative like that of Achsa? What we see, however, unfortunately, in Source 9, that as Perek Aleph of Sefer Shotim progresses, that indeed is not the case. Even the tribe of Yehuda, which seemed to have been on a momentum, conquering many areas, we learn eventually that the Yehuda decides not to conquer all of the mountainous area. Why not? Not to conquer the valley area. They conquer the mountainous area, but not to conquer the valley flatland areas. Why not? Because they allow the iron chariots, which was a major form of weaponry of the Canaanites, to overpower them, to cause trepidation among the tribes. Yehoshua had already known about these iron chariots, and he had tried to encourage them not to let these physical weapons get in the way of trusting in Hashem. And yet Yehuda falls short. It's interesting that we have first in these psukim the conquest of Yehuda, various areas like Azah, Ashkelon, and Ekron, and then the non-conquest of the Emek. Then we learn about how Kalev conquers Hebron. But then when we continue for the other Shvatim, over and over and over again, the refrain is that they do not complete the conquest mission. Binyamin does not conquer its part of Jerusalem. V'lo horish Menashe, v'lo Zvulun lo horish, v'Naphtali lo horish. The constant refrain is they do not continue and they do not complete the conquest mission. In fact, just the opposite. We learn, for example, with Menashe, v'yo'el ha-Kanani, la-shevet ba'aretz hazot. Vayoel is not a common verb. You might recall it from Shmot Perek Bet. Vayoel Moshe ha'ilashevet et ha'ish, that Moshe is invited and he willingly accepts the invitation of Yitro to settle in the land of Midian. Vayoel sounds like there's a willing invitation on the part of the tribes to allow the Kna'anim to remain in the Eretz Yisrael, and that we do not destroy them. In fact, even though we have the strength, Vayiki Chazak Yisrael, Vayasem et HaKna'ani Lamas, there is such war fatigue, there is such tiredness on the parts of the tribes that even though they could destroy the Canaanites and complete what they were supposed to do, Lo Techayeh Kol Neshama, they decide to take economic advantage of the Canaanites and they tax them. Vayasem et HaKna'ani Lamas. So much so that initially we read, Vayeshev HaKna'ani Bekirbo Vayu Lamas, that the Canaanites are living among us and we just tax them for our economic benefits. But later on we read, Vayeshev V'Ha'asheri Bekerev HaKna'ani, that it's as if the tribes are living among the Canaanites, not that they are living among us. Who becomes the majority and who becomes the minority? The tribes have obviously not maintained the momentum of the conquest mission as they should have. One other question that we need to focus on, therefore, is how do we understand the ramifications that the conquest has not been completed in the time of the beginning of Sefer Shofetim, where Othniel becomes the first Shofet, who ends up having to deal with an outside enemy, Kushan Rishatayim, from Aram? And how is it that Bnei Yisrael should have learned from the initiative of Achsa what their goal should have been as Am Hashem? Because what we see in this list that we have just read in Perek Aleph of Sefer Shofetim is that every tribe is being described individually. And that is what we need to think about when it comes to the fabric of our nation at this early part of our Jewish history. It seems that the people have fallen into individual tribes. There is not a cohesiveness among the people. There is no sense of unified nation, but rather tribalism. And that indeed is something that we also need to think about when we would even move from conquest to settlement. Would everyone focus only on their individual nachalot? Would they only be able to focus on their individual tribal inheritances? How would that prevent and preclude a national cohesiveness, a unity, which really must ensue if we are going to fulfill our spiritual mission? So that the Midrash teaches us in Source 10 in Masechet Tmurah something different about Othniel. Othniel is described in the Midrash as having restored and reconquered Torah. Kiryat Sefer, why was Deville called Kiryat Sefer, a city of the book? Says the Midrash, when Moshe Rabbeinu had died, during the time of the Avilut of Moshe Rabbeinu, many laws had been forgotten. And Hechaziran Othniel ben Kenaz mitoch pilpulo. And Othniel had reconquered Kiryat Sefer. Sefer Halachot, says Rashi, the Halachot that had been forgotten. And perhaps Devir, of course, reminds us of the Kodesh in the Beit HaMikdash. Devir from the word Dibur, that he is the one who spoke Torah and he revived Torah. And yet in that same Gemara, we learn about Achsa. When it says, Vatitznach me'al ha'chamor, the Gemara says, Ma chamor zeh kevan in source 11, she'en lo ma'achal be'evuso, miyad so'ek. Kach isha kevan she'en la tfuah betoch beita, miyad so'eket. Understanding Vatitznach from the idea of crying out, just like an animal needs its food and without it, it cries out. Achsa says, I have no parnasa. How am I going to raise a family? How will I establish myself? She says, the Gemara rereads her whole statement to Kalev, that Kalev has given her Eretz HaNegev, Bayit Minugav Mikol Tova. It is a household that does not have dry from any Tova. Because why? Because Kalev, you gave me Gulot Mayim. You gave me Otniel, who is a great Talmid Chacham, Mayim being Torah. But how am I going to have my Parnassah? And therefore, Kalev says, no, an individual who has gulot ilit v'gulot tachtit, mi shedar elyonim v'tachtonim, yivakshu mimenu mizonot. He says, not only is Otniel an individual in this world, the warrior groom, but he is an individual who learns Torah, trust in Hashem that he is going to take care. I think there's a lesson that we need to be learning from these midrashim about Achsa. And the perspective I would like to present is that in order to succeed, not only to succeed, in order to succeed as being a nation, having national sovereignty, not only do we have to conquer the land, but we need to conquer the Torah. What does that mean? In the Midbar, we had the man from the heavens. Now there is no more man. We have to work the land. We have to have a day-to-day living routine. We have to find our parnassah in a normal, perhaps mundane, physical way. But the question becomes for the tribes, how are they going to maintain the balance between kibush ha'aretz on the one hand and kibush ha'torah on the other hand? How are they going to maintain the balance between physical sustenance on the one hand and spirituality on the other? In the land of Canaan, Achsa understands that we need to focus on the physical day-to-day living, the sustenance, and that is very, very important. How are they going to root themselves and establish themselves in the land as a nation with autonomy and sovereignty? But that needs to be balanced with the survival of the spirituality of the Torah. And that is the couple, Achsa, Chamol, perhaps to reverse the letters, Chomer, meaning matter, physicality, spirituality, the Gashmiut, Ruchniut. We need to find that balance when we are living in Eretz Yisrael. And in fact, that is what Moshe Rabbeinu had warned in Sefer Bamidbar, that conquest is going to take a long time. It's going to be a very slow process. And if we are not careful and we do not drive out the Canaanites and we allow them to live among us, we will not be influencing them. Just the opposite. They will end up influencing us and they will become lisikim b'enechem v'litzninim b'tzidechem. They'll become stings in our eyes and thorns in our sides. And unfortunately, we backslide in Sefer Shofetim to Avodah Zarah. And it becomes the task of Otniel, the first Shofet, to bring us back, to do tshuva, so that we understand that we need to find that balance between settlement in the land, and as well, the spirituality that makes us special as Am Hashem. Already this is also indicated in the, I will end off with the Midrash in Source 13, that when Yehoshua dies, he dies quietly. There is no major avilut for Yehoshua. And the Midrash actually says, based on the fact that he's buried in Har Ga'ash, and the Midrash says there is no place known as Ga'ash in the Tanakh, Nit atzilu Yisrael lasod gemul chesed li Yehoshua. B'nai Yisrael did not do a chesed for Yehoshua. They did not do proper avilut for Yehoshua. What does that mean? Nitga'ashu Yisrael me'asot gemilut chesed liyoshua har ga'ash nitga'ashu. The Maharzu on this particular midrash says that ga'ash means trembling or shaking, making a lot of noise. B'nai Yisrael were making a lot of noise, but only because they were focused on their own busyness. What were they focused on? Look what this midrash says. Hayeret b'sha'a ota sha'a nechlecha Eretz Yisrael. Hayta haluka chaviva aleihem yoter midai. Hayu Yisrael oskim b'melachtan, ze osek b'sadeh, ze osek b'charmo, ze osek b'zeitav, ze osek b'fotzmo. Everyone was so interested in nachala, in itnachalut, that everyone was too busy in their own dalet amod. This one's busy with his field, with his vineyard, with his olive grove, with building their own homes. And as a result, because they turned so inward, so insular, they forgot the larger picture of being an Am. So Yigal Eyal emphasizes to us that the mitzvah of Hitnachalut is a very important mitzvah that this generation had. And Nishei Yisrael Yishtatefu B'mif'al HaGadol, the Nishei Yisrael, the women like Achsa, were the understood the responsibility of Hitnachalut, while the men were supposed to still be continuing the Milchama and the Kibush. And she took upon herself, Natala al Atzmat Achayut, Lahagshamat Hayud Hazeh, she thought about Hitnachalut, about settlement. But what her story also teaches us is that we need to think about the challenges and the ramifications when we move from conquest, which unfortunately was not even finished by the tribes in Sefer Shoftim, and that led to certain many, of course, deleterious consequences as the Sefer progresses. But she also motivates us to contemplate the ramifications of Hitnachalut, how we can accomplish this most effectively. And therefore, I'd like to end off with regard to Yom Yerushalayim. We read in Tehillim Kuf Chavbet that Yerushalayim is a city, Habnuya Ki'il Shechubra LaYachdav. Yerushalayim is a city that unites everyone. Shesham Alu Shratim Shifteka, Idut LiYisrael, Lehodot L'Shem Hashem. Yerushalayim is a magnet that unifies all the tribes to come and to praise Hashem in order and to focus on their spiritual mission. Achsa and Otniel together, they teach us with their initiatives the importance of Hitnachalut, but Hitnachalut with the proper balance that we need to be unified as a people with our focus not only on the Hitnachalut, the Gashmiut of settling in the land, but with the balance of understanding that we need to keep in mind the Kibush HaTorah, the spirituality that makes us special as a nation. Thank you very much and have a good day.